Hi, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to the Investec teleconference on the coronavirus, the economy, and markets. I'm Philip Shaw. I'm the Chief Economist for Investec in the U.K. Today, I'm really happy to have one of my Investec colleagues from our equity sales desk with me today, Roger Lee. In the very nicest sense of the term, Roger's an equity market veteran with 25 years of experience. He's lived through quite a few cycles. He takes a keen interest in the history and the behavior of markets, and he's got a number of observations on the current situation, especially with respect to comparisons with global financial crisis. The plan for this session is that I'll start and make some points on the economy and markets. I'll then hand over to Roger, who will speak about the equity market. And then, as usual, we'll have a Q&A session to wrap up. So, in terms of the economic outlook, we've now been in lockdown in the UK for just over 7 weeks. As you all know, we had some relaxation announced by the Prime Minister on Sunday, and some modifications were actually introduced last night, and they include allowing prospective home buyers to view properties, for example. And in the three-step process, two further steps are planned, including reopening non-essential retail, perhaps that's due in June, and then third step, including hospitality, possibly in July. And of course, how quickly we get there and exactly what's de-restricted depends on how successfully the virus is suppressed. And of course, there's been a lot of attention on estimates of the individual reinfection rates, R0, or now, as it's more commonly known, the R number. Looking globally, the number of reported cases now stands at over 4.3 million. The number of fatalities has reached 293,000. If we look in the UK, the numbers respectively are 226,000 for infections and a little under 33,000 deaths, which now include all settings. Where are we watching closely globally? Several places, I guess. I think number one, Russia, which has now the highest third highest number of reported cases. Brazil has 178,000 reported infections, and they are rising rapidly. And thirdly, in the US, where the fatalities have probably leveled off, but they're not clearly coming down. And, you know, that's coming alongside de-restrictions in individual states. If we look more closely at the UK economy, this morning we had data for Q1 GDP. They showed the economy contracted by 1.6% quarter on quarter in the first quarter. Specifically in March, activity fell by 5.8%. And that, of course, reflects the run-up to and the period after the lockdown on the 23rd of March. If we look at an international comparison, that's not as poor as China, where GDP in Q1 fell by 9.8% on the quarter. In the Eurozone, GDP dropped by 3.8%. Of course, it's the timing of events, in particular the UK lockdown, which means that the Q2 figures will be much, much worse, as indeed in other European countries. And as we get more surveys, more anecdotal evidence, such as, for example, transport usage, electricity production, furlough numbers, etc., we're still of the view that in terms of UK GDP, as the economy is placed into lockdown, we reckon that the rate of GDP shrank by 27%. Over the quarter in Q2. Now, just a sense of scale, and I know I've said this before, but it's worth repeating it. Over the global financial crisis, GDP declined by 6% from peak to trough, and that took place over a year and a half. Of course, what we're all looking for is what sort of a rebound are we going to get and when? And our view hasn't changed. We still reckon we'll get a rebound in GDP of around 30% in Q3. This, of course, almost, needless to say, depends critically on a gradual lifting of the restrictions over the coming weeks and months. And also to make the point again that it's a strange feature of the arithmetic that a 30% rebound does not undo or unwind a 27% fall because the rebound is from a lower base. We also maintain that what we judge as realistic is that, you know, despite our view that the economy is set to resume growth from the second half of this year, that by the end of next year, the economy will still not be where it was at the end of 2019. And our specific concerns are centered on a large increase in unemployment, possibly a fair number of business failures as well, suppressing demand over the longer term. And if I'm giving some real-time commentary over how our view is evolving, if anything, I'd be a touch less optimistic about the speed of the rebound now, as social distancing looks as if it's going to be maintained for longer, but not enough of a change in view to alter our central case. It's really a nudge in the nuances in the way that we look at the economy. Having said that, we maintain that shapes are more useful than the actual numbers, given the uncertainties in the shape of the economy. There's a lot of talk about a U-shaped recovery. What we're looking at is much more V-shaped. And again, I'll reiterate the point that it's a lopsided V, where the bit on the right-hand side isn't as steep as the decline on the left-hand side, but we wouldn't call it a U, and it certainly isn't an L. Turning to interest rates, the Bank of England kept the bank rate at 0.1% last week. Of course, as expected, it continues to conduct its quantitative easing program. That is buying £200 billion of bonds to take the total stock of asset purchases up to £645 billion. Really, we've got a big hint from the Monetary Policy Committee that it could ease policy further. Our view is that what we'll probably see is the Bank of England conducting a further £100 billion of QE. Because at its current fast pace, it's going to fulfill its £200 billion target by early July. And in terms of the timetable of announcing all this, we think that we're going to get an announcement on the 18th of June. That's the date of the next MPC meeting for that step up in QE. On another point on interest rates, and this is something which is getting more traction globally, the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, Ben Broadbent, yesterday insisted that the Bank of England is keeping all the policy tools under review. And it's not out of the realms of possibility that the Bank of England considers negative interest rates. Now, previously, the Bank of England was adamant in public and indeed in private that this wouldn't happen. But it's perhaps something that we might do some work on ourselves to see how the system could be adapted so negative rates could be potentially introduced. And if you look at the different futures markets globally, if you look at specifically US interest rate markets, they are beginning to price in the risk of rates going negative further out there. Despite the Federal Reserve not being keen, and indeed we've had a couple of Federal Reserve members over the past couple of days saying they don't really like the idea of negative rates. So that's a risk. It's not our central case, but it's worth considering this. Certainly, though, we're firmly of the view that interest rates will remain ultra low for quite some time, as, of course, the UK economy and indeed the global economy requires a considerable degree of support. As you know, there are a number of government schemes to support the economy. We heard yesterday that the business interruption loan scheme has been taken up to the extent of $6 billion. The bounce back loan scheme for micro businesses now stands at $8 billion. Yesterday, the Chancellor extended the biggest scheme, which is the coronavirus jobs retention scheme, the furlough scheme, until October from previously the end of June. And the specific timing of that, I think, reflected that Rishi Sunak was running into the deadline of the 45-day consultation period for redundancies, which would have gone beyond the June furlough scheme deadline. And although this has been extended to October, from August there'll be a request to companies to pay for part of the cost. This tells us two things, really. I think, number one, that the government believes it's absolutely imperative to limit the increase in unemployment. And we'd certainly agree with that, given the big second round effects, which could hammer the economy. And secondly, that in terms of asking for a contribution from business, Sunak realizes that the Exchequer is not a bottomless pit. And indeed, the cost of the coronavirus jobs retention scheme is absolutely massive. We've got official figures for the end of April, where the net cost is £39 billion. That's just over a month's worth. And indeed, there were reports in the press this morning about an internal Treasury paper which suggested that the cost of the coronavirus in total, including the weakness of the economy, will be at least £300 billion this year, obviously with consequent effects on the deficit and perhaps fiscal policy over the longer term. So that's where, on that sober point, I will hand over to Roger Lee. Roger, good morning.
Oh, thanks, Phil, and thank you all for dialing in. I am fascinated by market history, as Phil mentioned, and I was delighted to be asked to share a few historical perspectives to really see what context, what historical context we're seeing now, and specifically how the current crisis may or may not compare to the Great Depression of the 1930s. I know we use the word unprecedented a lot at the moment. It's almost become cliched, a sort of hackneyed expression. But the simple truth is we are living through unprecedented, unequaled times. Because the simple point is that at no point in history has governments ever intentionally and deliberately shut down their economies. At no point has a government ever forced businesses, factories, shops and restaurants to close. It's a set of deliberate and intentional actions to close and then reopen very sophisticated 21st century economies in order to protect their populations. And it's just never, ever been attempted before. But given there is no precedence, is there anything we can learn from the past to try and find a parallel, perhaps, to the experiences we are all living through in the present? One of my favourite quotations is perhaps the cliched and supposedly Mark Twain line, history doesn't repeat itself, but rhymes. And over the years, the veteran years, as Phil so kindly described it, I have tried to use history to understand or explain and perhaps predict market moves. So are there any rhymes we can see now? The rhymes, if any, today are certainly more complicated and more nuanced, because this has just never happened before. But I can definitely see some parallels with 1973 and the three-day week and the power cuts that changed behaviours both for industry and for family life. As it happens, I have fond memories as a child of my family sitting in front of the fire in darkness, actually talking together or playing board games in the flickering candlelight. I can see the deflationary risks following the 2007 financial crisis. Yesterday, the US posted the worst core inflation, or perhaps should I say deflation, since 1957. The rapid stock market declines are also highly reminiscent of the collapse in markets in 1987, which I can vividly remember, although I still can't really recall what caused the sell-off, except there was a very big storm. But the rhyme most frequently used is that this COVID-19 crisis is somehow similar to the Great Depression of the 1930s. Even the IMF's quarterly report was entitled The Great Lockdown, Worst Economic Downturn Since the Great Depression. So is that really the case? Are we about to live again through the most profound economic depression of modern times? Are there rhymes? Well, there are certainly some similarities, I think, between what we are witnessing now and the Great Depression, not least the gravity of both, the personal, the economic cost, and of course the human tragedy. The stock market volatility and economic shocks could also be similar. The stock market volatility from mid-February to even last night is extreme. The market falls in February and March, and then the rally in April all have echoes from the 1930s. March the 16th this year was the third largest single percentage fall in the Dow Jones in history. March the 12th this year was the sixth largest fall of all time. And the other record-breaking single-day falls? Well, October 1987. And then, October the 28th, 1929, October the 29th, 1929, October the 5th, 1931. And here's the rhyme. We saw the fastest 30% fall in the S&P ever. Again, the nearest rivals, February 1934, November 31, October 1929. But we've also seen some of the best days in stock market history. The 5th of March was the fifth single percentage day rally in history. Again, the only other days which were bigger were between 1929 and 1933. So yes, definitely the stock market volatility over the last couple of months, I think, could be said to rhyme with the Great Depression. So what about the economic impact? Well, Phil will be able to talk more in detail on this, and obviously he referred to it a few minutes ago. But the expected falls in GDP in the US as a result of the COVID-19 lockdown are indeed unprecedented outside the Great Depression, and that's according to the IMF. JP Morgan, for instance, are forecasting US GDP to fall 40% in Q2, and unemployment in the US to rise to a staggering 20%. Unemployment in the US is already at around 15%. In the Great Depression between 1929 and 1933, US GDP fell around 30%. Industrial production fell a staggering 46%. And in the 1933, unemployment in the US peaked at around 25% and didn't fall to 15% till 1940. To get these unemployment numbers into context, in the financial crisis, US unemployment peaked at 10% in 2009. So again, the similarities in terms of falls in economic output and the enormous impact of the job market can be seen to rhyme. But I'm pleased to say that's where the similarities do end. There is no more rhyme. So why is the COVID-19 crisis so fundamentally different, in my opinion, from the Great Depression? I think to see why what we are experiencing now is so different, we really have to look at what most people consider caused the Great Depression. And it isn't a singular event. It's now considered by most economists to be a series of profound policy errors. Contrary perhaps to popular belief, the stock market crash in 1929 wasn't in itself the singular cause of the Great Depression. As it happens, the market recovered almost 50% of its losses by mid-1931, similar as it happens to where markets have recovered to now. No, the causes were a series of policy errors following the crash that compounded the ever-worsening economic crisis that really only ended with the outbreak of World War II. And the stock market didn't recover all of its losses until 1954, 25 years after the crash itself. But these policy errors are just simply unthinkable in the current social and economic climate. Central to US government policy in the 1930s and the immediate aftermath of the crash was the policy of laissez-faire, or put more bluntly, leave it alone liquidation. President Hoover, in his memoirs, wrote bitterly of his then Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, part of the Mellon banking family. Mr. Mellon, President Hoover wrote, had one formula: liquidate labour, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmers, liquidate real estate. It will purge the rottenness out of the system. Can you even imagine Secretary Mnuchin or our own Chancellor ever contemplating such an economic strategy, or even if they did, trying to sell it to the people? The US government put up tariffs to protect US business that only started a global trade war. The Fed tightened monetary policy to protect the gold standard, causing further deflation. M2 money supply collapsed 30% between 1929 and 1933. To purge the system, government policy allowed banking collapses. It allowed corporate bankruptcies. It tolerated homelessness, and poverty spiraled out of control. By the time the US government did try to intercede, it was way, way too late. The first attempts to shore up the banking system weren't until 1932, and it didn't actually work until 1933 with the passing of the Emergency Banking Act. By the end of that year, though, a third of all US banks had already collapsed. But the lessons from the past have been learned by policymakers in the present. In this crisis, the Federal Reserve and the US government have done entirely the opposite. Within days of the crisis unfolding, interest rates have been cut to zero. Trillions of dollars have been pumped into the financial system to ensure that the banks have adequate liquidity. As a direct comparison, instead of a 30% fall in money supply during the Great Depression, M2 money supply at the end of April is up 20%. The Fed has injected more in the last month than the year after Lehman collapsed. Not one bank will collapse in this crisis. Trillions of dollars are being spent to ensure workers will either be furloughed by their employers or, if claiming unemployment benefit, in some cases they will be actually receiving more than when working. Direct payments for the first time in history are being made to each adult and child in the US, $1,200 per adult and $500 per child, directly into their bank accounts. And more direct payments are being proposed in Congress as we speak. Banks will offer homeowners mortgage holidays. There will be no homelessness as a result of this crisis. The US and the UK, for that matter, and the rest of the developed world have taken unprecedented steps to protect their economies and their people. But the most important difference is that this crisis will be temporary. Hopefully weeks, at worst months, before the lockdown ends, and as Phil was saying, economies can start to rebuild. Not years of economic decline and destitution that we saw in the 30s. There is no real comparison to the COVID-19 crisis and the Great Depression. But as it happens, you don't have to take my word for it. I doubt there is anyone living on the planet that knows more about the Great Depression and former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. He made it his life's work to understand why the Depression happened and how to avoid another. And he was asked why he had studied the Great Depression in such detail. And he replied, I think rather amusingly, if you want to understand geology, study earthquakes. If you want to understand economics, study the biggest calamity to hit the US and the world economy. And we were indeed very fortunate in the 2008 financial crisis to have Mr. Bernanke as chair of the Federal Reserve, when we were staring what could have turned into a severe deflationary depression. Now, when Mr. Bernanke was asked in the initial stages of this crisis, given all the historical comparisons that the media were making to the 1930s, and when he was asked, how is this COVID crisis going to be different to back then? He replied as follows. This is a very different animal to the Great Depression. It came from human problems, monetary and financial shocks that hit the global system. It has some of the same feel, a feel of panic, a feel of volatility. But it's much closer to a major snowstorm or a natural disaster than a 30s depression. It is quite different. I hope Mr. Bernanke is right. Although I must say, this feels worse than any storm I have been through, incomparable in scale and loss of life to many natural disasters. Hopefully, like any storm, it will pass, and I hope we are now through the worst. But as we are learning even this morning, and as Phil referred to, the financial cost, and more importantly, how to pay for saving the world from a global depression, will be the next challenge. I fear that one will be with us all for many years to come. Thank you. Phil.
Thanks very much, Roger, for that. I think you ended on an even more sober point than I did earlier. I'd just like to, before we start Q&A, just like to make a couple of points on that really interesting set of observations which Roger has made. The last thing an economist wants to say is, oh, well, this time it's different. because that is asking for a lot of trouble. But it is absolutely correct, and Roger did exactly that, pointing out the various differences between the global financial crisis and indeed the 30s depression with the current situation. And one of them is that the banking system is functioning well. And one example of that, for example, is that in March, UK corporates increased their borrowing by 7.4%, and that's 7.4% of the existing stock of loans to protect their cash flow, and the banking system was able to deliver that. So that's a big practical plus point. And in terms of what the global authorities are doing, for example, if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, in the beginning of March, the Fed's balance sheet was just over $4 trillion. It's now risen to be a little bit over, $7 trillion. So the amount of policy stimulus that's been pumped in is actually unprecedented, to use that term. One potential danger, different crises, different risks, and what we're identifying is just the speed of the decline is incredible. I pointed to the 6% fall in UK GDP from peak to trough in the financial crisis a decade ago, and the fact that we're likely to see something like 25 to 30% in Q2 this year. And the speed of these events is having black swan type effects and will continue to. So one example was that the swiftness of the fall in demand for oil in the States led to running out of storage space at Cushing, and therefore the West Texas crude going into negative territory for a day or two. And it's similar reactions like that that we should try and watch out for over the coming months ahead. So thanks very much for that, Roger. Could I hand back to Jess, who will give you instructions for the Q&A session?
Thank you. So if you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. Please ensure your lines are unmuted locally, as you will be advised when to ask your question. And please could we ask that you direct your question to a specific host. So once again, that's star one if you would like to ask a question. We do have a question in the queue, and this comes from the line of Scott Hamilton. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is a question for Roger. You mentioned how much stock markets have recovered since their lows. I think they're up about 30% since hitting the trough. How much does that reflect the prospects for the real economy? And if it doesn't, what is driving stock markets at the moment?
Oh, thanks, Scott. In CNBC fashion, that's a great question. But it does get it asked a lot. And I think it's this sort of tension that happens so often after a financial crisis. I mean, it's often talked about as Wall Street versus Main Street. How can stock markets be rallying, as you say, 34% when we have record unemployment? And it really comes down to this, and it's actually a very simple answer. The stock markets are in essence, a forward pricing machine. They're trying to price in what's going to happen at some point in the future, not necessarily what's happening today. Well, that's ideally how they should work. So essentially, the markets are looking forward to that recovery that Phil was talking about. They're looking forward to the rate of change of the economy as the economy basically goes from lockdown into more or less functioning again. And we can debate how well it's going to function. But the market is essentially pricing in that rate of change. And that's the concept that one's trying to get across. Now, of course, maybe too optimistic. That rate of change may not materialize. And a lot of people have views about that. Or conceivably, it could be too pessimistic and the world recovers rather quicker. human behaviour is such that we recover rather quicker than we might have anticipated. I do think Phil's got a point. I think some of the essences of one of the reasons maybe why the market is stalled where it is at the moment is because the realisation that some of these social distancing rules are going to hamper or somehow postpone or delay that recovery. But in essence, we're trying to price in some sort of forward recovery. And this isn't uncommon. In fact, it would be unusual if this didn't happen after a financial crisis. And I'll just give you one example. In 2009, the market rallied from its lows in March 2009. By August, the S&P had gone up some 50%. And yet unemployment didn't peak until October 2009. So again, you saw a very, very clear disconnect between what was happening in the real economy and the recovery that the stock market was pricing in.
Thanks.
There are currently no further questions in the queue. So as another reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one.
I've got a question for Roger, if I may.
Of course, Phil, but don't make it too tricky.
No, Roger, we are all looking at the an amazing scale of movements, perhaps a bit less now than a month or two ago in the main stock market indices. Is there much you can tell us about which stocks have been doing well, which less badly, in terms of broad sectors and perhaps how they relate to the crisis?
Oh yeah, there's been a very clear differential in stock market performance, and really you can look at it in terms of the very large U.S. FANGs, the Facebooks, Apples, Microsoft, etc. They have really provided a significant amount of the outperformance that the S&P has seen over international markets. There specifically has been a flight into what are perceived as quality stocks, large cap, generally very strong balance sheets, very secure, and they're the ones that have significantly outperformed over this period. The more cyclical stocks, whilst they have recovered from their lows, haven't really performed anywhere near as well as those large defensive stocks. And I think that comes back to that point about the uncertainty of the economic outlook. If the economic outlook becomes clearer, then you would expect the cyclical stocks, the more economically exposed sectors, to perform better. But at the moment, it has to be said that the running is really being made by the very large defensive names, and actually in particular the very large household tech names in the US.
That's great. Thank you very much, Roger.
Go ahead, Roger.
No, please come.
We have just had another question come through. This comes from the line of Des Fitzgerald. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. A question for Philip. I'm just interested in your view as an economist as to the actions that the US administration have taken, which a lot of people may consider maybe incompetent or dangerous, in terms of what damage that could potentially do. Given, you know, within the forecast that you were making earlier on, I mean, do you take that into account, or could they essentially do something which really would set us back?
Yeah, hi Des, thanks for the question. I think first off, the important thing is to acknowledge that the U.S. administration has produced a considerable degree of stimulus to the economy, and the House Democrats are trying to launch a third stimulus package in the order of about $3 trillion, including lending. So there's been considerable support to Main Street and to middle class America there as well. The essential problem, of course, is that Donald Trump is facing re-election in November, and he's, as he sees it, treading a very fine line between not allowing the economy to recover by that time and presiding over an uncontrolled spike in infections and of course fatalities as well. It's pretty difficult because individual states have different rates of infection. Of course, individual states have a degree of autonomy on what they can unlock, etc. So I think what Trump is facing is criticism from both sides of the spectrum. Some saying that he's not enforcing lockdowns enough, others saying that really it's now time to reopen the economy. So he's facing a very difficult situation. We had a big warning from Anthony Fauci, his chief medical advisor, yesterday, which is that if the restrictions are lifted too quickly, then you're not only looking at a big spike in fatalities, you're also looking at the setback to the economy, particularly if you have to reimpose lockdowns. And the parallel is actually the 1918 Spanish flu, which globally may have claimed up to 50 million people. And there's some great work that's been done across the United States on, you know, which cities imposed strict lockdowns and what the mortality rate was in each state. And that showed a big variation between individual cities, in fact, with places such as New York locking down very early and keeping fatalities down, Philadelphia doing the opposite. And places, I think, the interesting ones are like St. Louis, where they acted early, but they actually ended their lockdowns early as well, and they ended up with a second spike in fatalities, which exceeded the first spike. So I think history tells us, well, gives us some sort of precedent as to what can happen. Making the precise judgments are very difficult, but I think my gut feel as a layman, I guess we're all amateur epidemiologists these days, but as a layman, I look at the fatalities curve. It's probably peaked, but it's not coming down. And if Trump and indeed the individual states aren't very careful about how they end the restrictions, they could end up in quite some trouble.
Thank you.
There are no further questions in the queue, so I will hand back over to your hosts for any closing remarks.
Okay, thank you all very much for attending and for your questions. I'd like to say a special thank you to Roger Lee, who gave us a really good perspective on the Great Depression in the 1930s and the financial crisis and how the current situation is actually very different from what we faced then. Thank you very much all for attending. Please keep safe and well, and we look forward to your participation this time next week. Thank you all.